Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Drow Mystery by Martha Carr and Michael Anderley. Narrated by Stephanie Savannah. Chapter 1. Ellis locked the bathroom door, leaned against the sink, and waited for the automatic overhead lighting to click off. The familiar darkness should have been comforting, but anxiety crackled up her arms. Ellis hadn't been able to use her shadow magic in over a month. The pools of umber and violet in the room's corners mocked her. She glared at them, then plunged her fingers into the darkness. Nothing. "Mother below," Ellis whispered. It was half curse and half prayer. The Mother Below was the patron goddess of caves and shadows, and Ellis had apparently risen out of her grace into the light. She grumbled and waved her arms until the motion-activated lights flickered back on. Without shadow magic, it would be much harder to sneak into Amelia's office. Even after 8 p.m. on a Wednesday, Amelia would still be there. Ellis removed her grandmother's moonsteel lockpicks from her bun. She stroked the opalescent metal and remembered the birthday on which she'd received them. Nan Elandra had lived to the formidable age of 206. Impossible for a human, and ancient for a drow. She'd died when Ellis was 8, which was the year Ellis's life had veered from hard to unbearable. The Industrial Revolution had pushed the drow away from the human world, and the advent of modern technology had sent them underground for good. Ellis's grandmother remembered the time before 100 feet of sedimentary rock separated the two races. Back then, the border between the real and the unreal had been fuzzier. There was room for myths to intrude on history, and the magical and physical to interact. Ellis was not the first human Nan Elandra had met. Nan Elandra had robbed some of those humans blind. Whenever Ellis had a difficult time in the creche, she'd go to her grandmother's small, dim chambers, and Nan Elandra would hook her cane around the handle of a wicker basket under her bed and pull out a treasure trove of locks. Some were old 19th-century Polhem padlocks and mortise locks from the Roaring Twenties, but some were new. One had been stamped with a recent year. Ellis had never asked where her grandmother had obtained it. Ellis's grandmother would then pull the moonsteel pins out of her silver hair, which fell over her shoulders like water in moonlight. Her hands cramped too badly to pick the locks herself, but she instructed Ellis on how to hold the pressure with the first pick while she worked the tumblers with the second. When Ellis made a mistake, Nan would pound her cane on the floor, which rattled the locks in the basket. Ellis would shriek, and they would laugh. Nan also taught her to pick pockets. Nan's eyes would crinkle as she circled her cane like a maypole while Ellis attempted to steal mushroom sweets. She'd say, "A time will come when the drow must leave their hidey holes. When that day arrives, they'd best have a few who can survive on the upside." Ellis had learned fast. She considered her reflection. The grass-green romper she'd bought from a Highland Park boutique now struck her as idiotically flashy. She was accustomed to disappearing, so dressing conspicuously did not come naturally, but it was too late to change. She left the bathroom and hugged the shadows along the wall in the corridor that led to Amelia's office. The thick hardwood door bore an elegant brass plaque with Amelia's name inside an embossed border of bromeliads. Ellis wrapped her knuckles below the plaque. When there was no response, she pressed her ear to the door. The only noise was the low hum of the air conditioning blowing through the leaves of potted plants. Ellis tried the handle, which rattled without turning. She slipped the lockpicks into the keyhole. Hector called her name from down the hallway. Ellis instinctively reached for the shadows inside the keyhole to shroud herself, but it was as useless as pushing the wrong ends of two magnets together. The hot resistance seared her fingertips, and when Ellis yanked her hand back, she left the moonsteel lockpick behind. Ellis spun toward the bromeliad's jack-of-all-trades facilities manager, carefully blocking his view of the lockpick stuck in the door. Tight, chocolate-brown corduroys hugged his muscular legs, and his smile pushed Ellis's anxiety into fluttery, unfamiliar terrain. "Amelia's gone," Hector informed her.
She went to a fundraiser at the Natural History Museum.
That's a shame. I meant to drop something off before I left.
I can give it to her tomorrow morning. I have to be here at O Dark 30 to meet the wholesaler for the cafe.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
Hector's mica gray eyes sparkled as he held out a calloused hand.
Please. I know how Amelia is about her deliverables.
Ellis smiled wanly, cursed silently, and reached into her bag.
You could have just said you needed to talk to her.
Her fingers closed around a cool metal object attached to a wide titanium ring, the prototype grapnel Percy had helped her make. He'd designed internal electronics to replace some of the bulky mechanical controls so she could ditch the clunky utility belt. She couldn't give Hector the grapnel, but his suspicion was growing. The next item she grabbed was a blackout silk bag, and she hauled the frictionless fabric out of her purse and thrust it into Hector's hands.
Here, she blurted,
then pasted on a too bright smile.
Thanks so much.
He frowned at the midnight black material.
What is this?
Young Drow used blackout silk bags to develop their shadow magic skills. The fabric was so tightly woven that it admitted no light, so the darkness within was a potent source of magic. Ellis had taken to carrying one in the hope that the educational tool would provide a whisper of her old powers. It hadn't.
It's a sleep mask, Ellis ventured.
Hector lit up.
How does it work? The light from the building beside mine shines into my bedroom window, and my blackout curtains aren't cutting it.
I'll show you.
She snatched the silk back, then eased the material over her head and tightened the drawstring. Rich, deep darkness enveloped her. A year ago, it would have been comforting. She stuck out her arms in a magician's ta-da.
See?
Hector snorted.
You look like you're about to be guillotined, but okay.
He pulled the bag off her head, and she winced at the brightness in the hall. Then she stifled giggles as he put the bag on and murmured appreciatively. It did look funny. Hector removed it and held it up to the light.
What's it made of?
Ellis froze.
Special silk. Made in Italy. By nuns. Blind nuns.
Hector blinked, then shrugged.
Cool.
Damn it, Ellis. Too many details.
Nan Alandra had never dealt with humans who'd learned to Google before they'd learned to walk. Hector waved the bag cheerfully.
Anyway, thanks for the tip. I'll ensure that Amelia gets it.
Ellis bit her lip. That was her only blackout silk bag. She couldn't stroll into the homestead to get another one. Hector stuffed the bag into his pocket.
While you're here, I know it's late, but could you take a look at a mushroom problem?
Sadly, it was not a euphemism. Ellis acquiesced, and after Hector turned around, she hurriedly popped the lockpick out of the lock before she followed him to the elevator. On the way, they chatted about the newest season of Sven on the Ice, in which Sven was betrayed by Hilda, his long-term partner. The Norwegian crime drama was the only TV show Ellis had watched in its entirety. Her limited pop culture knowledge made talking about popular media dangerous territory. Questions like, what's a mermaid, tended to raise eyebrows, so it was a relief to meet a superfan of the one series with which she was deeply familiar. In the elevator, Hector selected sub-basement 2, which housed their mushroom grow-op. Ellis stared at the keyhole beside the button for sub-basement 3. The secret level taunted her, but a camera hung from the ceiling. Picking the lock was the first item on her "When My Shadow Magic Comes Back" list. If it comes back.
How long have you been working for Amelia?
Ellis kept her tone light. Hector was an excellent co-worker, but a brick wall when it came to personal questions.
Long enough,
he replied amiably.
How much do you know about her?
Why?
The amiability transmuted into questioning. Ellis plastered a stupid smile on her face. That usually deflected suspicion.
She's impressive. Definitely a role model.
Hector's broad shoulders relaxed.
I certainly wouldn't want to be her enemy.
That was an interesting response. Was it an innocent comment or a threat?
Ellis decided not to push her luck. The digital display ticked down to sub-basement 2, and the door opened onto a warren of narrow corridors and locked doors with a ding. Ellis often worked on the mushroom grow-op, and she'd never run into anyone but Hector, so she'd already picked many of the locks. So far, she'd only found dusty junk, like stacks of old office furniture, discontinued hotel linens, and obsolete computers. The closest thing to danger she'd encountered was boxes of old invoices that threatened to bore her to death. She found it a pleasant place to work. It had been weeks before she'd realized that it reminded her of the Swallow's Nest, and she missed the homestead more than she wanted to admit. Moving surface side had highlighted her drow heritage in ways she'd never dreamed of. Hector opened a silver door at the end of the corridor. The gentle hiss told Ellis that the climate control systems were working. The light inside was lovely and dim, with a faint pink glow from the heartstopper mushrooms. Harsh light flooded the room when Hector flicked a switch. Ellis resisted the urge to grumble. It wasn't his fault he couldn't see in the dark. The grow-op occupied four rooms in the sub-basement, one for each storage, inoculation, incubation, and fruiting. Comfortingly familiar sawdust filled the storage room, but the rest of the equipment was far more scientific than Ellis was used to. That had turned out to be a boon when her shadow magic gave out. The fruiting room, where the mushrooms grew to full size, had the square footage of a small apartment and spotless concrete floors. Floor-to-ceiling metal racks lined the walls, and there were two freestanding racks in the middle. A blocky air conditioning unit sat at the back. It was supposed to be a perfect, all-in-one climate maintenance solution. "What's the problem?" Ellis asked. Hector made a face.
"The humidity. The unit isn't providing any moisture."
Ellis stood in the middle of the room and drew a deep breath of cool air. The temperature felt right, but it was arid. 14%? She estimated. The wall-mounted digital monitor showed that she was spot on.
"How do you do that?"
"Practice." The real answer was, she had a drow father who was a stickler for tradition. The drow could acquire modern humidity meters, but Connor Burton preferred to control his environments by feel and instinct. Ellis grabbed a small screwdriver from the workbench and opened the enormous AC unit's case. The evaporators were working, and none of the lines were clogged. She checked everything from the intake to the outlet, but found no problems. After she closed the case, Ellis put her hand over the outlet and felt moist, almost misty air. Curious. She paced the room with her hands outstretched. Near the door, the air was desert dry. Was something wrong with the growth medium? She admired the vibrant rust caps in a nearby tray, then plucked one. Its dusty ferrous coating rubbed off on her fingers as she popped the mushroom into her mouth. It was like eating a soft penny. The cafe wouldn't be rushing to do a rust cap stroganoff anytime soon. When Ellis swallowed, a rush of energy drove her pulse against the small capillaries in her temples. Watching the change in her face, Hector chuckled.
"They are remarkable, aren't they?"
Ellis nodded, then considered the heartstoppers. They were smaller than a thumbnail, and their bright pink spots were so vivid that she'd had to convince Hector they weren't poisonous. In the Swallow's Nest, people grew them for their beautiful pink glow as much as their aphrodisiac properties. She wasn't sure it would be wise to binge aphrodisiacs in an enclosed space with a coworker, even if he did look nice in that soft cotton shirt. She wandered over to the midnight blues instead. She'd never had much use for the dark, feathery cones, which improved skin moisture and elasticity. Maybe she would change her mind when she was Amelia's age. Extra skin moisture would be welcome in this dry air, however. The specimen she pulled out looked fine. "Down the hatch." She broke the fleshy trumpet in two and offered the other half to Hector. He took it and grimaced when he put it in his mouth. Ellis picked a speck on the wall to focus on as she chewed. Her grandmother said midnight blues tasted like month-old meat from a cave goat with a bad personality, and her grandmother had liked midnight blues. Ellis suppressed a gag as the rotten flavor spread over her tongue. "Ugh, they taste like they're supposed to." Hector shuddered, then sympathetically offered her a bottle of water, which she gratefully swigged.
"Nothing should taste like that."
Ellis frowned. Everything looked and tasted right. So why were her lips chapping? "Have you noticed anything?"
"The midnight blues are going through wood chips at twice the rate they're supposed to." Don't know if that means anything.
Ellis peered into the plastic-wrapped blocks of wood chips. The mushrooms looked fine, but the growth matrix had sunk, as though the underlying structure had caved in. Ellis poked the hole left by the midnight blue she'd picked, and something wiggled under her finger. She yelped and pulled it out.
What's wrong?
Hector's skin was a shade paler. Instead of meeting her gaze, he looked at a spot just above her head, where the overhead light cast flickering shadows. His pupils were black holes that sucked out the color in his irises. Uh-oh. The trumpet-shaped midnight blues twisted and pressed together like gaping, oxygen-starved lips. Ellis plunged her hand into the growth matrix as her heartbeat sped up. The wood chips pulsed in her hands, and she ignored her brain's insistence that a sleek, limbless predator lurked in the spaces between them. Her fingers found a hard, round lump. Oh, shit. I found the problem.
What is it?
She held out her hand. The lump was not much to look at, the size of a raisin, and the color of bone china. Ellis had encountered one once before, in her early teens. It's a nightmare node.
A what?
Ellis examined the lump, which appeared to pulse. A nightmare node. It's a parasitic fungus. I've seen it before. Don't freak out. We're hallucinating. She glanced up and screamed when the metal racks behind Hector buckled in and enfolded him in gnashing silver jaws. Hector shouted in response to her outburst. So much for don't freak out, Ellis. She clamped her eyes shut. When she opened them, the racks were a rectilinear grid, and aside from the extra eyeball on his forehead, Hector was fine. It's a parasitic fungus, Ellis repeated. That's why the humidity has been wonky. They're serious hydrophiles. They've been sucking water from the air. Hector's face twisted in disbelief. At first, Ellis thought he doubted her diagnosis, but then he yelled,
How am I supposed to trust a woman with snake hands?
And backed into the metal racks in the center of the room. The midnight blues wobbled and released silver powder into the air, which settled on Hector's hair and skin. He started to hyperventilate, and the overhead lights made the tiny hallucinogenic flecks glitter as he sucked them in. Ellis reached to pull him away from the shelf, but he screamed. Oh, right. Snake hands. Damn it. She hid her hands behind her and took a step back. We have to leave. Hector vehemently nodded, which shook mushroom dust out of his hair. Ellis kept her hands behind her back and shouldered him to the doorway. In doing so, she received a face full of spores, and the scent of rotted meat coated her nostrils. Hector moaned as he approached the door. To Ellis, it stretched to twice its normal height. There was no telling what Hector saw. He shrank back, then steeled himself and opened it with a shaking hand. A crimson sheen bathed the hall beyond. It resembled slick intestines. It's not real. Ellis shoved Hector into the hallway, then slammed the door behind them. Snake hands be damned, she pulled him toward the elevator. Sunlight, she exclaimed.
What?
Hector stopped abruptly, and Ellis slammed into him. She growled and hit the call button. That's how we fight it. Sunlight will burn away the hallucinations. The elevator door opened. Ellis thought she saw something inside leap onto the ceiling. It's not real, she repeated. She dug her fingernails into Hector's arm and pulled, but he wouldn't budge. He stared into the elevator in terror. Come on, she insisted. If they didn't expose themselves to full sunlight within the next 12 hours, the psychic damage could be permanent. Ellis didn't want to break down any doors. She wrapped her arms around Hector's waist and bent her knees. Hector yelped in surprise as Ellis threw him over her shoulder and dashed into the elevator. She pressed the button for the top floor with her knee. He thrashed and pounded her back with closed fists, then went still. When the elevator creaked into motion, she set him on the floor. He crawled into the corner.
Witch,
he whispered. She thought that was what he'd said. Halfway through rolling her eyes, an unseen pressure pinned them in place. Oh, mother, they'll stick like that. Something was controlling her. No one's controlling you. You've been poisoned. Ellis blinked twice. Then she could look at Hector again. We'll be fine. He did his best to melt into the floor, and she sighed and moved as far away as she could. Ellis tried not to stare at an undulating shape in the overhead light. The elevator doors scraped open on the top floor to reveal blackness. Ellis knew there was a normal hallway there, and she forced herself to step into the void. Ellis manhandled Hector down the hall and up the fire escape stairs, although she didn't have to carry him again. That was good, since she wasn't sure how to grip someone with so many tentacles. One door stood between them and the open air on the rooftop. Then, the helicopter haze of Los Angeles pressed against them like rotors whirring on an enormous eye. The eastern horizon was dark. Right. It's nighttime. Maybe the fresh air would help. Hector scrambled away from some unseen horror toward the edge of the roof, and Ellis grabbed the waistband of his corduroys. No one would dive into traffic on her watch. "It'll be okay. We just have to make it to dawn," she told him. Hector nodded, then squeezed his eyes shut. A harpy howled, and Ellis looked up to see a huge predatory bird. Its talons were poised, its beak was wet, and its eyes were wrong. One was an evil black bead deep within its turkey vulture bald head, and the other was a yolky bulb. Ellis covered her face with her hands until the horrible vision resolved into comprehensible reality. "Wormy?" Hector's nails dug into her arm. "Don't talk to it!" "That pigeon is a friend of mine," would raise questions. So Ellis explained, "It's a pigeon. I've fed it Cheetos." Wormy squawked. In their hallucinogenic haze, it was a world-conquering shriek. Ellis and Hector pressed together and tried to sink into the roof. When she looked up again, Wormy had retreated to the far end of the building. Dawn came painfully slowly, but eventually sunlight filtered through the haze. Ellis and Hector crossed to the east side of the building and stretched toward the light on tiptoe. Wormy hopped along the edge of the roof and stared until they took a half-step back. The dawn light was gentle, but it burned Ellis's skin. The low fire reminded her of eating cinnamon candy, but it pushed back the torrent of hallucinations. Wormy shrank from a looming terror bird to her true form, an ugly-as-compost pigeon. When she cooed, the noise was pleasant. Hector, who was regaining his color, suspiciously stared at the pigeon. "There's something wrong with that bird," Wormy squawked in offense and gyred skyward. Ellis hoped the pigeon would forgive her, or at least not get her in trouble with Percy. "I'd better stock up on Cheetos." Hector spread himself out like a cat in the sunlight. When Ellis walked over to him, he complained, "You're in my light," but his face crinkled in a smile. "I'm so sorry, Hector." She couldn't believe she'd missed the nightmare nodes. They were a rare occurrence in the Drow's Mushroom Caverns. She hadn't anticipated that they could pop up in the human world. "Stupid Ellis. Underground is underground." The nodes were probably rare because the mushroom attendants paid attention and prevented them. Hector nudged her out of the sunlight with a toe.
"It's not your fault. Unless... you weren't growing those things intentionally, were you?"
"No. It's a disease. I would have stopped it if I'd noticed." Hector's eyes reflected the hazy white sky.
"That was like being in a horror movie."
"I'm sorry," Ellis insisted.
"Don't be. I love horror movies."
Ellis offered him her hand. He grabbed it, and she easily pulled him to his feet. A strange look came over his face.
"I seem to remember you throwing me over your shoulder like a feather boa."
Ellis loosened her grip. She trusted Hector, or wanted to. He was a competent, reliable, and hard-working mushroom farmer, but he was loyal to Amelia. He dodged every question about the bromeliad's glamorous owner, who had her finger on anything in L.A. that had a pulse, and some things that didn't. Until Ellis understood those relationships, she would be wary of sharing her drow upbringing, and she would not reveal her shadow magic to Hector. "If it ever comes back..." Ellis smiled. "Hallucinations are funny that way. Are you afraid of strong women?" A faint blush crept up his neck.
"Not particularly."
He was too bogged down in Freudian self-reflection to ask questions on the elevator ride back down. The soft ding of the doors opening broke the silence. Framed by the steel doors, Amelia Bronson perched on elegant, sky-high stilettos. She took in their tousled, sweaty appearance and raised an amused eyebrow over a knowing smile. Ellis started.
"Why are you here so early?"
It was barely 6 a.m.
"Sleep is not the most valuable use of my time," Amelia replied. "Nor yours, it would seem."
Ellis was about to protest when Hector stepped forward with a self-satisfied smile.
"Ellis and I were on the roof, watching the sunrise."
Amelia wouldn't care if they were sleeping together. She might care that a hallucinogenic parasite had contaminated her grow-op. Amelia tittered delicately and insincerely.
"Get some sleep. I need to talk to you about a cafe project, but it's not urgent."
She had a tinge of annoyance in her voice.
"Sure thing, boss."
Amelia disappeared into the elevator with a dismissive wave. Ellis turned on Hector.
"Why did you say that we were doing the horizontal lumbata on the roof?
That we were together on the roof?"
"I didn't say it. I implied it," Hector replied. "Don't look so offended. I'm not sure I can take any more psychic wounds tonight."
"She'll think we're totally unprofessional.
We just poisoned ourselves with the nightmare dust infesting our farm. We are unprofessional."
He had a point. Ellis blushed, and she didn't try to hide it. She pictured the flinty look on her father's face if he found out she had let a nightmare node infestation get out of control. He was proud of her fungi culture. Aside from shadow magic, it was the one skill that had given her value in Drow society. Now she was a failure as a mushroom farmer and as a shadow magician. Tears welled in Ellis's eyes. She instinctively reached for shadows to conceal her humiliation and came up empty, which made her cry harder. Hector's eyes widened.
"Ellis? Ellis, I'm sorry. I didn't realize it would upset you. I thought it was our best chance of avoiding the third degree. I've only seen Amelia's temper twice, and I do not want a round three."
Ellis shook her head and wiped her face with her sleeve. "It's fine. It's been a long night. I'll see you later." She fled to the bromeliad's garage. Chapter 2. The drow had a saying, "Fire wasps attract cave widows." Fire wasps were annoying since they resisted shadow magic, but extermination required only moderate effort. A bad infestation, however, attracted insectivores, particularly cave widows. Cave widow bites would kill you if an anti-venom poultice wasn't immediately applied. Therefore, fire wasps attract cave widows meant that small problems led to big problems. Percy said the comparable American saying was, "A stitch in time saves nine." Both sayings came to mind when Ellis's motorcycle broke down on the ride home. She managed to steer to the shoulder without falling off as the engine sputtered. She dismounted and kicked the tires. The apple-red bike was sleek, small, quiet, and thoroughly unreliable. It had broken down 6 times since she lost Granny, her Harley. Granny was languishing in the LAPD's impound lot, an unwilling guest of the state. Memories of the old girl chewed at Ellis's guts as she walked the junky red motorcycle along the road. She wanted to take the plates off the bike, dump it in the nearest alley, and let nature take its course. Perhaps everything that was happening to her was a punishment for abandoning Granny. She couldn't ask Charlie for help. He'd been quiet since the attack at his captain's house. If she was in mortal danger, he'd probably show up. But "I lost my motorcycle during a bank robbery. Help me steal it from your employer" was unlikely to elicit sympathy. She was exhausted, and hunching over the broken bike made her shoulder ache. She grew more annoyed as she walked, and a rough outline of a plan bloomed. "I might not have shadow magic or mushroom skills, but I'm still a kick-ass vigilante. Kick-ass vigilantes don't abandon their noble steeds." Ellis burst into her apartment. "Who wants to help me rob the LAPD?" 12 pairs of eyes blinked at her, one of which was human. Percy Rawlings, wearing an embroidered silk robe and neon pink pajama pants, perched on a stool at Ellis's breakfast bar. Complex code covered his laptop screen. Ellis could barely use a cell phone, so she doubted she would ever understand Percy's work. She blinked at his robe. It appeared to have a fur collar, but Percy was a committed vegan. She realized the luxurious fur was a living...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?